As soon as we started filming, prior, I sort of did a lot of reading in the beginning, but once we started filming, I didn't want to think of it as real. I just took a step back and just went, this is just a fantastic show that I'm working on. I had to disconnect a little bit because I didn't want to have nightmares for 10 months.
I had the opposite reaction. I felt like, you know, like I needed to know as much as I possibly could about each of the different serial killers. So I was reading about them, their lives and their histories and the crimes that they committed, and then trying to, you know, imagine what the experience would be like as an FBI agent trying to track these guys and stuff. So I became kind of obsessed.
It's, to me, it's, these are very sad people under, who've, you know, grown up under horrendous circumstances. This is not to, you know, overstate how much empathy or sympathy we should have for them. It's just simply a fact. And it becomes, and we had seen so much, you know, of this sort of literary conceit of there's a very fine line separates the hunters from the hunted. And I really thought it was time to sort of take that back and make it really, the reason that we are fascinated with them is because we're nothing like them.
Hello and welcome to Real Crime Profile. This is Jim Clemente, retired FBI profiler, writer-producer for CBS's Criminal Minds, and colleague of...
Laura Richards, criminal behavioral analyst and former New Scotland Yard, author of Dash and Policing Domestic Violence, and co-creator and executive producer of The Case Of.
And I'm Lisa Zambetti. I am the casting director for Criminal Minds, where Jim Clemente is my colleague.
Well, it's great to be back in the studio with everybody again. And we're continuing our coverage of the Netflix original series, Mindhunter, created by John Douglas, Charlize Theron, and David Fincher. And we're up to episode 5. In this episode, Bill and Holden continue to question suspects. These are people that the local cop, unfortunately, is warning or giving them prep time because he just does not believe that they could be involved. And so they're kind of, well, one of them is pissed, the other one is trying to cut him a break, and it's causing conflict.
So I wanted to mention this actress again, and I promise I'll shut up about this from here on out, but the casting of Jackie Renee Robinson, she plays Rose, the wife who appears to be getting beaten up by her husband Frank, and she's the sister of Benji, the prime suspect. This actress, Jackie Renee Robinson, if you can hear the sound of my voice and you come to Los Angeles, you need to find me, because I would love to cast you on Criminal Minds. She does a brilliant job. She has done basically nothing before this, according to her IMDb page. And she does a fantastic job as this beleaguered young wife. The other thing I wanted to give a shout out to Fincher, his use of wallpaper in this episode is mind-blowing.
Really?
Yes.
In what way, Lisa?
Wallpaper.
So there's a thing in the Fincher canon, if you watch a lot of his movies. A lot of his character and atmosphere is conveyed through texture, through things in the background that you might not normally notice. And it's subtle, but it's there. So if you're looking for it, you'll see it. You also see a bunch of Easter eggs, shout outs to his earlier movies. Like he plays the song, what's that song, Paul? Meatloaf Sings?
Paradise.
Paradise by the Dashboard Light. So they play that in this. Meatloaf, of course, was in Fight Club. Anyway, there's a million little details like this. But please, please, if you love cinema and taking it apart, look at the textures, look at the wallpaper of every room that a character walks into. It just will tell you a lot about the character if you are noticing.
Well, what do you want? You just took us totally on a tangent. And
sorry.
Took us totally on a tangent. It's alliteration for you.
Okay. I'll try to get us back in. So the other thing that Fincher does is he focuses on objects like a glass of milk, donuts that Benji's eating as they're interrogating him. The camera just plays with these objects, and it makes you either paranoid or hypersensitive, and that's important to profilers, as we've talked
yes.
about, is noticing all these details. So Fincher does it with his camera as well. So we meet poor little Benji, whose fiance has been murdered, and he looks like he's the prime suspect. Even though he's this little guy who's crying and eating donuts and
drinking
milk. It just
felt very set up and staged to me.
Yeah.
And the whole donut thing and just, yeah, crying almost on demand, it felt wrong. Maybe that's a credit to Fincher and just the way that, you know, he'd put this scene together. But, you know, certainly lots of red flags in terms of the way that he interacted, that you would expect lots of questions to be asked of him. But the actual setting up of, you know, he was prepared, basically. It wasn't a cold door knock going in. It felt like it was, you know, rehearsed and he was ready to give his version of events.
Which is why we don't necessarily want to let the subject of the interview know that we're about to interview them. And so I think that was a lesson. They're trying to demonstrate lessons that were learned throughout the course of this research because, again, some of it wasn't intuitive. Some of it was just mistake and analysis and redirecting your efforts. And so I think this is a perfect example of why the FBI advises that if you're going to interview a suspect, the more time in advance of the interview the suspect knows about the interview, the less likely you're going to be able to determine whether or not they're telling the truth. They'll be able to get their story together and rehearsed.
I think there was just an interesting nudge to psychopaths mimicking emotions and, you know, how do you tell when something's genuine and when it's not? And he gave the explanation about, you know, the crying can feel wrong if there's a lack of vulnerability there. And I've certainly seen that in not just numerous cases, but in interactions with people, that these things might be a vote to get somebody off the hook at the time by trying to show vulnerability, but actually it may not be true vulnerability. You know, the tears, we call it the crocodile tears, you know, that's done for effect, it's cosmetic. It's the same as people can smile, but are the eyes actually smiling? You know, and you look for all those little baseline things, micro expressions, and there's a lot more going on, you know, just profiling faces and body language and looking for things like vulnerability. And if it's absent, then it could just be an emotion that someone wants to evoke to get a reaction that's favorable to them.
Right.
Yeah, so there's this interesting scene where
there's a woman sitting there and she's drinking.
Yeah, so they're trying to trace Beverly Jean's last steps. And the last thing she did was went and had a drink at this bar.
Mm-hmm.
And so an interesting conversation ensues between red-haired cop and Holden and Bill about what's a woman looking for if she's alone in a bar. Well, it depends on who she is and how you see her. The same woman, you know, can be sitting there ordering a drink, but your perception of who she is and what she wants can drastically change. Is she there looking for sex? Is she waiting for a friend? Is she looking to get married? And what kind of a woman she is? Mm. Because they're trying to figure out who Beverly Jean really was. Was she a tramp? Was she the good girl? What, you know, who was she? And it was just this really interesting conversation based on perception.
Yeah, what's amazing about that is that I basically did something like that when I was in law school and I was poor. I would take a milk crate and go down to Times Square and sit on a corner and watch people go by. And you'd get little snippets of their conversation and their behavior. And I'd try to figure out who they were and where they're from and what they were all about just from that little snippet. So that is
that
a trait.
I do that on the tube a lot in London.
Yeah.
Working
that,
out their stories
yeah,
and traits.
Yeah, that is a trait of profilers. And it's something I naturally wanted to do, so it was great when I discovered profiling and when John Douglas and when Pete Smerek came into my FBI new agent training class with me and Jim Fitz sitting next to each other and talked to us about the behavioral science unit and profiling. And we were both totally engaged. We both totally decided we wanted to do that for a living, and we were lucky enough to both get into the unit and work there for more than a decade.
But going back to that conversation, you know, single women in a bar. I mean, of course, times have changed now. And so, you know, I think it's far more commonplace to see women in a bar, in a restaurant, you know, on their own.
Sure, they're people. They get to do what they want.
Exactly. I mean, it's a freaky thing, isn't it?
I know.
But the interpretation of that act, I mean, we go back in time, you know, and that conversation that they're there for one reason, you know, maybe it's because women were much more used to be seeing in the family unit and being at home, being the housewife. And so it's a cultural nod to that time.
Yeah.
But I mean, currently now, when I spend a lot of time on the road and I'm traveling, I mean, you do go into restaurants and bars. And I think, you know, over the last 10 years, attitudes have changed. I think previously people would look at you slightly oddly, as if you're there for a particular reason rather than you're there for a function.
When if you think about it,
you want to have a drink and you want to get
right.
something to eat.
When you think about it, maybe it's the guy's just projecting, because when they go into a bar, they're hoping to meet a woman who's alone so that they could pick her up and have sex. So they're projecting that onto the woman when, like you said, they want to have something to eat. They want to relax and have a drink, maybe meet people and chat, watch the ball game, whatever it is. There's all sorts of things that could be going on. And to try to actually pretend that you can profile a whole person from one behavior is kind of ridiculous. It's kind of like, you know, I'm sure you get it too, Laura, when people come up to you at a party and say, oh, profile me. You know, and you're like, well, you have to understand something. Profiling is actually when you don't know who the person is. What you're talking about is do a personality assessment on me, and that's a little more difficult, and certainly it's not a party trick.
And ridiculous to ask you. That's so I'm offended on your behalf that people do that to you.
They do. I mean, it's
time.
Commonplace.
Yeah. Anyway, this is a little off track, but there was one guy who kept asking me to profile him, and it was at an event in another city, and he kind of threw a little pizza party after one of the nights of the events. And I was in, he had it at his hotel room, which was a suite. And he invited me to come. And I noticed that he and I were the only real adults there. I mean, he was probably, I don't know, he's probably in his late 30s. I was probably in my mid-40s. And the rest of the guys there were all like these 17, 18, 19-year-old guys. And they were all the helpers at this event. And, you know, this guy kept telling me, you know, he goes, oh, I want you to profile me. I want you. And I said to him, no, you know, it's not a party trick. You know, it's, you know, and I said, by the way, you don't want me to do this in public. And he goes, no, we're like family. And that just reaffirmed what I was thinking. And so I said, all right, you sure you want me to do this? And he said, yeah. And I said, okay, well, first of all, I could tell that when you were probably in your late teens, you lost a very close friend. And immediately his eyes went wide. He looked at one of the guys and was like, what? How did you do that? And I said, and you've never really gotten over that. And, you know, this was a very close friend of yours. And, you know, you always, from that point forward, sort of felt that as a tragedy in your life. And so you reach out to guys who are in trouble in that sort of age range. And you try to save them. And you sort of build your life around this as a goal. And I said, and, you know, if you were a bad person, you know, because a bad person in that situation would take advantage of those young guys and, you know, maybe sexually abuse them and go to that extreme. But you're not a bad person, are you? And he's like, oh, no. But I said it deliberately in front of the guys because I believe that was what was going on. And so the next day, my buddy who I was traveling with, you know, came to me and said, so how'd it go last night? Because he went off and met some friends. And I said, well, it was really disturbing. And I told him what happened, and I told him what I said. And I said, here's the thing. He goes, that's really creepy. And I said, yeah, but here's the thing. What's going to happen is when we see this guy again today, I'm going to bring it up. And if he changes the subject, you know I am exactly on point, that I was 100% right. So when the guy showed up, I said, you know, we were talking, and then I said, oh, yeah, that was pretty interesting, you know, party last night. And he goes, yeah. And I said, yeah, you know, I actually profiled this guy. And he turns to my friend and says, well, you know, what happens in the Hilton stays in the Hilton. And my friend looked at me and said, oh, my God. So I think we both knew at that point what this guy was all about. Now, I think these guys were just barely legal, but I know that this guy was taking advantage of them. I could just tell by their demeanor and his demeanor. But it's one of the things. I mean, profiling does work.
Yep. Yeah. So don't ask for it.
Well, don't ask for it unless you, you know, aren't worried about what you're actually doing.
God.
Anyway, sorry for that rabbit hole, but no, I think it was a good explanation of how we do what we do. It's literally, some of it is actually while you're delivering it, seeing the dynamics and the testing the water and things and sort of adjusting what you're saying as you're saying it, as you're seeing the reaction of people and confirming things like him saying at the last minute, no, we're like family. You know, it was a very, weird dynamic. And anyway, I'm glad I called him out. And hopefully, I did also say, you know, I told, you know, indirectly told the guys that were there, you know, that there's help, that that's not the only, the only avenue isn't to continue being in that situation, and that I had been in that situation when I was a teenager, and, you know, how I got help and so forth. So there was hopefully some good that came out of it.
I'm sure there was.
Please stop analyzing me.
I'm not analyzing.
Run this little commentary on everything I do.
I was talking about your work. That's how we communicate, right? You talk about your job, I give my opinion.
Maybe I don't always want to hear your opinion.
You mean when I'm not in agreement with you?
Could you just be my girlfriend? Could you just listen?
You mean shut up and adore you?
I mean, you could try it.
Well, speaking of weird dynamics, back in this episode, the profilers are realizing that these three people, Rose, Benji, and Frank, there is something weird about that whole dynamic. About he has a violent background and has been treated for aggression, but it doesn't seem like he's the killer. But Rose definitely knows more than she's saying. So there's sort of this trifecta of lies going on. And who finally figures it out is Dr. Wendy Carr. Because she realizes, because she studies, she listens back to the tapes and realizes that Rose has a tell in the story where she describes the body having, the blood is splashing, which wouldn't happen if she were dead.
Right.
And so Dr. Wendy realizes, oh, okay, they were all three there and they were all in on this murder.
Well, they go back and they do a crime scene reconstruction, basically. Mm-hmm. And that was a cool device to use because that's what we have to do. And over the course of our careers, we do this literally thousands of times. We look at the behavior exhibited at the crime scene and we figure out what went down in what sequence. I think one of the most important things that we looked at in the JonBenet Ramsey case was when Dr. Werner Spitz gave us the sequencing of the injuries. And that really helped us put everything in perspective. And so the autopsy is going to be very important. The crime scene and how it is left is going to be very important. And the blood spatter evidence can be incredibly important because many times it's layered. So you have to kind of unpeel the layers and see what happened first, then second, then third. So it's reverse engineering crime, which I kind of loved doing because I thought it was an amazing way to use your brain.
And listening to someone's descriptives, you know, the language that they use, you know, her hearing that it was in action rather than it had finished, well, it puts her there, but it doesn't mean to say that she was active in the killing of Beverly Jean, but it certainly shows it's more likely that she was present and that her account, the version of events that she gave, wasn't truthful. So next starts the round of putting together, you know, an interview or interrogation to try and find out the truth from each individual and hear their accounts and what corroborates and where some of the gaps are, where's some of the deception, and you know, where's the veracity, because there will be some truthful parts in there. As we always know, you know, with lies there tends to be a kernel of truth, but the web of deceit can become quite large. And in terms of offenders, I mean, these three don't strike me as being particularly sophisticated. So when you lie, you can get cognitive load. It's a lot to remember when it's not the truth. So there'd be some clear things that they would be putting together in terms of the interview and interrogation to try and get to the truth of what happened. We didn't talk about her domestic violence.
Right, and that's a little detail that when they're interrogating Rose, they can see the bruises on her arms, and so they know that Frank's been beating her, and this is probably why she's an accomplice to this, because she's afraid of him.
Right. Beaten her, and she was 8 months pregnant, you know, right. And pregnancy creates vulnerability as well. something bad certainly did happen, but to what level she was involved in it and complicit or active. Was she being coercively controlled? You know, there's a fear for her child as well, you know, being concerned that they're all arrested and that the baby loses her. And so there's a lot of things that she, and the risk to her if she says something and she could end up being killed. So she's having to assess a lot of different things. But yet again, we've got domestic abuse and the coercive control strand running through this particular case.
Right. And I think that this would be an example of a female offender who was coerced by one or two male offenders. And mm-hmm. part of the reason why she participated in this was because, one, she was being physically abused and coercively controlled. And two, she was trying not to rat out her brother, basically. He got involved in this, took it to a certain point, and they felt it was the point of no return, and so they conspired together to actually get rid of her. And but they did it in a way that wasn't as criminally sophisticated as it should have been if they were going to get away with it, and between that and their behavior, the profilers are able to suss out who really did it and why.
And we've said it before, but I'm going to say it again, because it always depends on someone's biggest fear, you know. And if her biggest fear is that the baby will be taken away, or the children will be taken away, or that she will be killed, then no doubt she will be coercively controlled and will comply. And of course, those two individuals, her partner and brother, will know sort of her vulnerabilities as well and be able to use those things and exploit them. So there's a lot going on within that dynamic between the three of them.
Right.
I don't feel we really get to it, you know, of what it is. But certainly the disclosure around domestic abuse was no real surprise to me.
Right. And it wouldn't surprise me that, you know, that there was some more very bizarre behavior going on between the three of them, because I think it was probably part of the husband's control over Rose. But as we get into episode 6... they do piece together that all three of them were involved, and that, as I've said before, crime scenes and crimes are dynamic in nature. So things can change over time. And they dumped her body, but later Benji took what we call trophies or souvenirs. I would call these souvenirs. The difference between a trophy and a souvenir is a trophy is something that you sort of show to others, and whereas a souvenir is something that you keep for yourself, right? You're not going to show others this. But for example, if you take the necklace off of a victim, and then you give it to your wife or your girlfriend, so you see it, you know, it's a reminder, it's there. I would call that a trophy, okay. Whereas a souvenir would be something you'd kept hidden. It's sort of like the distinction between collecting something and stockpiling something, because when you collect it, you usually show it off in a showcase and share it with other people who have similar desires to collect those things. Whereas stockpiling is where you're hiding it. You're hiding it for a nefarious reason.
And when the killer has a trophy that's out in the open in plain sight, is it kind of like a secret, like...
Yes, thrill?
And they get off on it because, like, you don't know about this, but this thing around your neck is... I don't know.
Absolutely. I think it's another layer of into their fantasy life. And obviously, we know a lot of notorious killers did those kinds of things. And there's a bunch of them that hid their souvenirs because they didn't want anybody to find out.
I mean, imagine what it takes to bludgeon someone to death. The lust for control, the feeling of arousal, the decision to humiliate her corpse. How could you possibly get that from an ordinary police report?
I can choke down the bile, manufacture empathy when our subjects are at least informative.
We decided no one was beneath our contempt.
I'm trying to warn you, your attitude is going to bite you in the ass.
So again, with victims, we know that they operate from fear a lot of the time, what their biggest fear is. And so the police officer, the cop, intuits that, and he starts to pressure Rose by saying that it won't be good for her or the baby if she's lying. And he understands that he could probably get her to talk. And that's when we get the disclosure that there's domestic abuse, no doubt coercive control, but also we see the bruises on her arm. And that was no surprise to me, but she would be very concerned about her baby and the future and obviously the lie. Just because she's at that scene in the bathroom where Beverly Jean's being assaulted and killed, that doesn't mean to say that she was physically active and complicit in that. It places her there. So
right.
There's definitely a lot more questions to be asked.
Right. And it could be that she just didn't intervene because she was scared for her life or her baby and so forth. But clearly it bothered her enough to motivate her to come in and actually admit that they had all been there.
I think it's Dr. Carr that kind of figures out all the dynamics, that Benji had hurt Beverly Jean and knocked her out and tied her up. Frank then comes and rapes her and eggs on Benji to stab her and forces Rose to become complicit as well by coming in and helping clean up the scene and they bury her. So Wendy kind of puts that all together, but then they realize that they can't really get a conviction, or at least the DA doesn't think he can get a conviction on all of them.
Wimp.
Because they can't.
That's just ridiculous. And this is the kind of thing, it goes back to Marsha Clark not wanting to put on the domestic violence case.
Which is a clear domestic violence and stalking
yes,
case. So why not see it for what it is
exactly,
and prosecute it?
Exactly. And I think the complexity of it, yes, it takes more work. Yes, it's going to be more difficult. But you don't just let people go just because you don't think you can prosecute them. I think a dedicated public servant will make the effort and try to do it and use the expertise of people like the behavioral science unit, behavioral analysis unit experts. But I think this is, you know, just a lack of justice because somebody didn't have, you know, the understanding and the ability to explain that. But, you know, you get who you get when you go to DAs. Obviously, there was a particular one involved in the Keepers that we're all very just pissed off about because she absolutely allowed the victimization of just many, many, many girls and boys based on just her ignorance or her lack of desire to go after the Catholic Church.
And, you know, to go after low-hanging fruits, it's the easy option, the easy target. But a clear case could have been made, you know, even around the coercive control aspect and the domestic abuse and bringing in experts, as Jim said. But there was no real problem-solving or no appetite to do that. It was just, you know, their analysis and their ability to be able to turn their knowledge about the case and to use them as experts, that was just falling on deaf ears. So it must have been incredibly, you know, and we see it time and time again, it's incredibly disparaging when that happens.
And the line is, what difference does any of this make if we can't communicate it to the people who matter, either the jury or the justice system? And the rest of this episode, it's actually a short episode. It's only about 30 minutes long, which I thought was great. This is what I think. You know, in this platform, you make up the rules. You know, it's not like on our show where we have to hit those breaks.
43 minutes,
and we're constrained by certain things. Clearly, the creator said, you know what? This is what we want to focus on. We don't need to have a whole hour about this. And I think that's great. It's the same thing in podcasts, in the podcasting world, if I may digress. I think it's great that sometimes you have an hour and a half episode or a 30-minute episode because the creators are deciding what goes into it. And I think that's very powerful. And that's why people do Netflix shows, because the studio isn't telling them how long something has to be or how many acts your show has to be. But anyway.
But they actually said they wanted to make it a non-network type show. You know, it probably was one of those things of just trying to break the mold. And if it fell into that and they wanted to stay tight and focused on that, then they did the job within that episode.
Well, I think in honor of that, we should make this a 30-minute episode.
Exactly.
I'm serious, because we're there and
we're
sort of at the end of the discussion for episode 5 and 6 and episode 7 and 8 and 9 and 10 all have their own.
Huge. I know everybody wants to talk about the tickling principle. But before we leave this episode, we do get to see some of Dr. Wenge's backstory, how she has this life back in Boston with the beautiful Lena Olin and their life there. And she just kind of blows it up. She's not going to stay there. She's going to join her Quantico
cohorts
full-time, and that must have been, if that really happened, you know, a big thing to step away from academia and tenure and all that stuff. So,
but to have to do it, to have to step away from your relationship, mm-hmm. because you don't think you'll be accepted, I think that was definitely something that was an issue back then and still remains, unfortunately, in most of law enforcement.
Absolutely. And so Dr. Wenge moves down to, where is Quantico? What city is Quantico?
Virginia.
Quantico is a city. Uh-huh. It's the city of Quantico. Oh. It's actually the Marine base of Quantico. And it is in Virginia, and it's about 50 miles south of Washington, D.C. And I-95, the highway, splits the base into two sides. And on one side of it is where a lot of the schools are. And on the other side is, you know, airports and all sorts of tactical things. And the FBI Academy is nestled in the middle of, I think, 9,000 acres or something.
Mm-hmm. Well, Dr. Wenge goes down there. She gets an apartment. And if we remember what was on her walls, let me know, because it's very indicative of her character. Anyway, so there we are. Episode 6.
Yeah, just to say about Wenge, I mean, I kind of like the twist and the backstory there, because again, it humanizes her. We get to see, it reveals about her own personal life and just difficult decisions that as human beings we have to make, and she prioritizes the work. But I agree with Jim, my read on it was that it wouldn't be an accepted part of, you know, what she would bring to the table. Mm. And, you know, I think that that's going to develop further. And then you kind of get the whole backstory in the apartment with the whole cat. Yep. Or whatever it is that's going on down in the basement. Mm-hmm. So that's another arc that's running across this show.
It's kind of interesting because, you know, when we saw that, when she's going down and feeding the cat, I thought, uh-oh, this is dangerous. There's something going to be very bad that happens there. So it never really resolves.
I just love that quirk, not really a quirk, but just sort of a aspect of her character that she's not quite so easy to figure out. You know, she has this urge. She doesn't quite know why to feed this cat and to be down there. I don't know. I just loved that little idiosyncratic thing about her character.
And her eating habits.
And her
of just eating like a tin of tuna when she gets back. You know, there's some interesting idiosyncrasies there, whether it's just because she's so busy. But I think she's an interesting character that I'd like to see more of and
Absolutely.
Learn more about.
She's very feline, too, to me, in a way. I guess her character just feels, maybe that's why I find her as being cool and clinical. But anyway, and so the episode goes out to Boomtown Rats, their famous song, I Don't Like Mondays, which is a great way to end episode 6.
A ominous way to end episode 6.
All right.
Well, that's it for this episode of Real Crime Profile. When we come back, we'll be talking about episodes 7, 8, 9, and 10. On Real Crime Profile.
If you like our podcast, there are a few things that you can do. You can take 2 minutes and go to Apple Podcast and leave us a 5-star review. You can also check out all Real Crime Profile offers and promotion and our sponsors in our show notes. Another thing you can do is go over to Facebook and like our Facebook page. And one last thing is please tell all your friends, family and colleagues about us and spread the Real Crime Profile word. Thank you so much for listening to us. We really appreciate you.
Real Crime Profile is produced and edited by Paul Francis Sullivan. Sound engineered by Terrell Parham. Music composed by Simba Tsumba. Logo art by Jim Clementi. Real Crime Profile is produced by XG Productions and distributed by Wondery.
For advice and support if you're experiencing stalking in the UK, you can contact Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service. You can go on the website www.paladinservice.co.uk.
In the US, if you're experiencing domestic abuse and need advice, safety, shelter or counselling, call Genesis, the 24-hour hotline. Go on their website, www.genesisshelter.org, or the domestic violence hotline on 800-799-7233.